Hi everyone, welcome back to Not About the Weather. This is episode 28 of our little podcast that could. And today we're going to just talk to you about some things that we've been thinking about. So I am one of your hosts, Natalie, and today I have with me Mitch and Arianna to chat about their feelings and whatnot. So we'll get into that in a few moments. In the meantime, if you want to reach out and talk to us on the internet, you can do that on Twitter or any other form of social media. Instagram and Facebook are not the greatest communication tools, but they exist. We have a Gmail address, and all of the handles are at NATW Podcast for any of those. So at natwpodcast@gmail.com. Our website for full episode show notes about anything that we mention in the episode that you might want to look up afterwards is notaboutheweatherpodcast.com. That account is also a Tumblr account, which you can follow and send us an ask if you want to. You can plug that website in and it will be hosted on your personal Tumblr and show up in that feed if you wanted to. That is what we do, basically. We're going to start today talking about our hypes and gripes of the current moment in a segment we call An Obsession to Share and a Grievance to Air. And does anyone have a feeling, a mood, a vibe, or a coin toss decision about what should go first, hypes or gripes?
Let's do gripes first because I've had a rough day, and so I want to end it on a high note.
That's a good attitude to have. But you sound like you're ready to unload. So would you like to go first, Arianna, with your gripe of the week?
Oh, not really. But I guess, I mean, I was trying to decide between doing like a gripe that would really frustrate me or one that would just be kind of fun. So I guess since we're talking about it, I'll just do what frustrates me. And my general gripe for the world right now is like the unethical way that we treat service people, like people who work in the service industry. Mm-hmm. It's just really frustrating to me how we dehumanize like the people who perform jobs for us. Mm-hmm. And it really makes me angry. And that's it.
Did something happen?
No, it's just based on my life.
I mean, we've spoken about this before. You know, dehumanizing in any role is a bizarre thing that people fall into, like that they just forget the connection between human beings about like how will people act about like a homeless person asleep in their way or how people will act about on the total flip side of privilege, a celebrity who's like just trying to live their life on the street. You know, or, you know, any of those. But what it falls smack bang in the middle of with service people is that's such a common part of everyone's day. There's always a hierarchy in your workplace of who you work for or who works for you. And then there's a hierarchy out in the world of like, you know, who gets, you know, who makes your lunch or fills your car or whatever. And it's all just an exchange of different people with different skills helping your life to run. And it is something that, yeah, people do really dehumanize. You and I have talked about this in terms of tipping culture, in that to me, in Australia where we don't tip, tipping feels dehumanizing, but obviously it's still a monetary transaction.
What? I didn't know. Really? You guys don't tip at all, ever? How am I just hearing this, especially in having as many conversations as we have about the world together?
Well, we tip for delivery drivers and stuff, but it's not built into people's living wage. So it's not...
I know. It's so bizarre.
There are people who... You know, in America, my understanding of the service industry, like when we're specifically talking about like hospitality industry, that kind of thing, is that they go in on a very low wage and they're expected to like make up the money that they need by giving good service and getting tipped directly from the customer. That doesn't exist here. You have a wage that you're employed by the company to have. and tipping is, you know, people might do it, you know, in a restaurant or, you know, when they've left behind, you know, like, you know, leaving behind the change at a restaurant or a delivery driver. But if they don't do it, the person's still taking home the same amount of money from the employer at the end of the day, and that amount of money is a minimum wage, which is much higher than yours. So it's a kind of a gratuity. It's literally a nice, you know, gesture, but it is not something that anyone in my country has to depend upon to get their pay, like to get the money that they need to live in their job. And so therefore, when I am in America where the service culture is so different, tipping someone feels stressful to me because it feels dehumanizing. It feels like instead of genuinely treating them like a human being who I'm interacting with, I am relegating them to a servant and just being like, you know, off you go with your money. Yes. Which I know is not the attitude that they actually feel when someone's giving them money. It's a good thing, but it's very different.
It does feel in some ways, though, like I see what you mean, Natalie. Like there is something kind of gross about it, and that it is kind of like, oh, let's watch the monkey dance. Like, you know, there's an expectation that they have to not just be like cordial and like a general human to human way, but like that they have to perform for you and be like make sure that you are, I don't know, that you have a superb experience because their livelihood depends on it.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, it's kind of like, it reminds me of, you know, a man in a top hat and a monocle riding a horse and, you know, flicking a farthing to the street boy to, you know, boy, go and get me a newspaper so I don't have to get off my horse, if you know what I mean. Yeah. It ties into that for me, but it does go much further than that, regardless of money. It goes further than that in many, many industries, merely in the hierarchy of a workplace or in anything like that. And I don't know, like, do you have anything, not necessarily anything personal that you want to share, but like, is there something that you want to kind of talk about?
Not in such a way as that I can get into the details of my life.
Yeah, yeah, but of course.
It is just very astounding to me, like how quickly people, I mean, it's not astounding. It's very natural, I guess. How quickly people like adjust to having someone do things for them. And so like, if, like something that would eventually, that would start off as like a favor or like a, like, oh, what a treat that, you know, I have someone, or like, you know, what a treat that I have this server serving me, eventually becomes like an entitlement thing. Like, how dare they not?
yeah. I absolutely know what you mean. Yeah, it is frustrating in any scenario when you break down the parts of everything that we have and everything that we're able to do and how quickly we complain about it. Like, you know, that, you know, it's funny that you say, because it is human nature, and how we treat each other is one part of it. But you think about like anything, you think about like people complaining about slow internet, like slightly slower internet than usual on their phone. And it's like something like that. And it's like how, like within recent memory, we did not have the opportunity to walk around the streets with the entire history of human knowledge in a small block in our hand, if you know what I mean. Like and that kind of thing was an amazing privilege, and now there is just so much, as soon as it becomes normal, then it becomes
an entitlement thing.
Yeah, entitlement.
Humans, we adapt to entitlement very quickly.
Yes, that's true, and it's unfortunate.
Well, wasn't there a Twitter thread going around? I didn't explore, but there were a lot of people that were speaking of, like, if you think celebrities or someone in Hollywood working at I don't know, a gas station or in a restaurant is bad. Don't, because everybody's human and we have all needed to. Here are the jobs that I've worked in. I don't know. Was there like a thread that started all of this? Like a issue?
Yeah, that came up because a gentleman called Jeffrey Owens, who was one of the other lead characters on the Cosby Show.
Which, by the way, I would like to say before that, before all of this happened, he was always my favorite. Elvin was by far the funniest on the show. Well, and also just like for considering he was like from the 80s, just like as a character, he was the son-in-law and
progressive.
He was very progressive. Yeah. He was like the one who took care of the kids, and he was just like such a nice, soft boy.
Yeah, and he's got a lovely face. Like you can, he's got a, you know, like that's all in his demeanor. But yeah, Mitch. So this gentleman was photographed working at Trader Joe's department store. Obviously, you guys have that department store. We don't have it in Australia,
but it's actually a grocery store.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yes, that's what I meant. A grocery store. Looks like a very nice one. I've been in one a couple of times.
They also have great benefits, which is why I actually worked when I was a teacher. One of our other teachers worked at Trader Joe's because they gave her health benefits and our job did not.
Yeah, that's what I've heard since this has come up. But he was photographed at Trader Joe's working as a retail employee between jobs because he lives in the East Coast and he's a working actor, and that might mean like one episode of random series as a guest, you know, star once in a while. That is not enough to survive on. Like that, people who are working actors, that's very common. But because he was once very famous, some people took photographs of this, and then Fox News made a big story about how embarrassing it was for him. And
that's like a TMZ kind of thing.
It was horrible. It was Fox News and then other people, made it worse.
I think the Daily Mail and Fox News.
And then of course, other people, defended that. And like many, many people in the industry were like, this is completely ridiculous. This is cruel. Like, it's like, this is not news. Like, millions of working actors have jobs, like other jobs. And then the deeper part of it is that, one of the reasons why that may have been necessary for him, because he was so famous or he was on such a successful show from the past, is that Bill Cosby's, allegations of
the show's no longer running,
sexual abuse and things like that means that he gets no residuals from repeats, royalties from the show being aired every episode, because most people who are in something very successful, same as like a very famous singer who had a one-hit wonder, if it was, as much as it gets repeated, you get a check every month of like the little royalties from that, and for some people that's enough to survive on. So because the Cosby Show has been blacklisted everywhere, the other Cosby Show actors would not get that residual check very much anymore. And so that's probably another factor as to why that, why he may have had to like up his workload in other ways. But regardless, it was just an example of that, that terrible attitude about the value of different jobs that people can perform, for themselves to make money or for other people to, to help them. It's ridiculous. But yeah, that's how that came up, Mitch, that's why right. The online community was talking about that, because there are lots and lots and lots of actors who work in between creative work because they don't necessarily have creative work that can pay a full-time job.
Well, even if they do, like sometimes someone might want to work a job for joy. And if that's Trader Joe's because you like their food and their environment and their people and their benefits or whatever it is, then that's fine. Like no one else has to define what kind of job you can get. Well, sure. I'm sure like Natalie, I'll keep it in your realm. Like you wouldn't see like Jensen Ackles out probably working in a grocery store, not because maybe he would want to, maybe he wouldn't, but you really kind of can't securely do that at a certain fame level. But now we're seeing you can't even do it without like a certain shame level, which I've never really expected society to get to that level, but it did. So I guess it's just a thing.
Yeah. I don't think it's about, I think what you're saying about a fame level is not quite accurate. It's more like full-time work As in,
well, I'm saying security wise, like you wouldn't see someone that's seen all the time on TV now go into working into a public place because like it literally wouldn't be safe. There wouldn't be a way to get the work done either because they would be so interrupted, I feel.
I mean, well, that. Sorry, go on.
Sorry. No, I mean, that's just, it's kind of like a little beside the point though, because like he had said, Jeffrey Owens, that, you know, he did get recognized every day when he worked there as someone who was once famous would. But, you know, people were usually just like cool about it. And he said he worked there for 15 months before someone took this picture and posted it. So, I mean, I don't think to be honest, I don't think he wanted to be working at Trader Joe's. That's not his passion. Acting is his passion. Right. But he's a human being, and like all of us, we're just trying to survive here and put food on the table, and not everybody can work their dream job all the time. Mm. He was just being a regular American, like blue collar worker. And so if you're shaming him for doing that, then you're shaming everyone who just has a job to feed their family.
Yeah. That's the thing. Mitch, I think that you're focusing a little too much on like people can do what they want. It's less about what they want and more about
what they need to do.
The cruelty of someone saying, you know, someone who was once famous doing something that normal people do to make money because they need money as being like a terrible thing. Like, you know, I know like bands, musicians, it's pretty common. Like unless someone is like, got millions and millions of dollars in a recording studio. I've known many musicians who tour in bands who, you know, they take annual leave holiday from work to do a tour or they have a job that's flexible, but they still have a day job when they go home and are not touring or making an album because it's just not that lucrative, despite the fact that their band might have played on television and people show up and take pictures with them after the show. We're not talking about One Direction level. You know, we're talking about like a rock band who might tour around in a tour bus. You know, fame is not as lucrative as we have all glossed it up to be for a lot of people. Like, yes, there might be times when your creative work is funding everything you need in life, but that's not ever assured as permanent unless you hit an amount of earnings that has you being set for life, which not that many people do. And I think it sort of goes a little bit in hand with what Ariana was saying about, adapting to privilege and adapting to being complacent or entitled. Our attitude about reaching a certain level of fame or others reaching a certain level of fame and what that means is really delusional and really dehumanizing. So it's all very, very strange. And I think that, you know, it's best for everyone to take a breath and think about every day that everyone is achieving, you know, the same continuation of being alive, and it's all just random weirdness, and any value is just value that we've arbitrarily assigned to whatever it is, and that this hierarchy of importance about what where you are in life and what you've achieved and what it benefits you to have that is not permanent, it's not owed. And it does not serve you well to ever act like it's permanent or owed in any way.
Yeah, and I think also to perhaps wrap up this discussion in a clean way, we can keep a not about the weather thread here. If you go back to episode 26, Natalie referenced a special encounter she had with Darren Criss. Well, I guess we'll save the conversation as a bit of an advertisement if people want to go back and listen to that about celebrities just kind of, I guess, in a related way, being in public and it being not a big deal. So maybe that's a more positive way. That's the other end of the spectrum, I'd say, to this conversation.
Oh, I mean, it's not that big deal. But interestingly, what you were saying about the fact that you brought up Jensen Ackles, no, he wouldn't necessarily go and work in a grocery store. But he does run a brewery, him and his wife, in a hands-on way, where he will be there behind the bar, and it's not a gimmick. It's just, it's literally, you know, he don't need any money for the rest of his life. Like, you know, the amount of, again, like the amount of episodes and the amount of residuals from episodes that they've done, those actors are very much set for life. But they're operating a business as not a vanity project. They're operating a family business because they want to, and they very much are able to do that. I mean, they're privileged enough to go and do that in terms of being able to afford to start a new project. But yeah, they've, you know, it's everyone's just trying to do stuff and be treated normally while they're doing it. And I don't know, it just shouldn't be that hard. And it is quite nasty to witness people's attitudes change, I guess, over time about what they think they deserve. Yeah. But in a day-to-day, you know, because Ariana, you know, she's, you know, not going into specifics, but that you hear a lot of these kind of horror stories from people who have a similar job to hers as a, you know, assistant to, you know, someone being in a creative industry where someone's a big boss and their assistants get all beleaguered. Like they had that, you know, what the film, Ariana, what was the film
Set
called?
It Up.
Yeah.
And, too real.
Yeah. And you know, we do. Like, so that's a whole other thing in how bosses treat, you know, their people who they've hired to basically run their life for them. And it's kind of like, if you look at it the other way around, I'm like, okay, so you, big boss, have just turned yourself into like a helpless little baby who doesn't know how to live without someone like putting things into your hands. That's probably not great. And, you know, they might have more important things to dedicate their brain power to, but it is a very interesting like detachment of like, oh, I've forgotten how to function normally without people doing things to me. And I would just never want to get in that position if I was them.
No, I wouldn't either. Stay humble, people. That's the moral of the story, really. Yeah. Because you never know when you're going to end up in someone else's shoes that you used to think was lower than you. I mean, there's that, the serious quote from Harry Potter. I doubt I have to quote it, and I won't be able to get it exactly, but judge a man by how he treats his inferiors. And yeah. Sirius kind of broke that anyways from how he treated Creature, but still.
that's very true.
Sirius Black, such a complicated, problematic fave.
I was going to say, he's definitely a problematic fave.
Well, I'm sorry that you have that source of frustration, Ariana, and I hope that, you know, you will become a wonderful, powerful woman who treats everyone kindly for the things that you have to pay them to do to help you out.
Thank you. But I don't think you have to be powerful to treat people kindly. We can all do it in our daily lives with just the people we interact with.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
Like the people who help us at Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
Trader Joe's is great. Yeah, you should treat them nicely at any place, but especially Trader Joe's. They're there for you and they have great food.
And Uber, even though I've had one or two Uber drivers that I was just like quite unsettled by, only one or two, but the things that are coming out about them, I keep having drivers be like, yeah, if we get below a 4.6 stars or out of 5, like we get deactivated and are not allowed to drive anymore. And it's like, okay, so if you rate someone like below 5 stars, basically, because you can only rate 4 or 5, like you can't. If you rate someone below 5 stars, you're putting their job at risk. And if you rate them at 5 stars, it's basically, oh, you successfully took a taxi from A to B, basically. Like I don't – it's just bizarre, like, the level of treatment that people are apparently – depending on it's, I don't know, it's very, all very strange, but
I mean, yeah, it's come to the point in my life where I have easily cut out people if I'm out in public with them and they are rude to not only just strangers, but especially to service people or just like too much. Like, I don't know, getting too emotional to someone that's literally just doing their job because something didn't go right or getting too angry or demanding way too much, way too quick and not being human. Like, I think everybody should have that goal of literally just being human. Like, as Adriana has said, it's not hard to be kind. You treat people as you want to be treated. It's a golden rule for a reason. Follow what your mama taught you.
Hmm. And it's interesting because I am a million times more patient with strangers, with service people, and with, yeah, you know, with dealing with strangers. I'm so much more patient with them than I am with, like, I'll snap over something at home much more easily than that. But it seems like there are plenty of people that are the opposite of that, that are like, they'll be happy to like get frustrated in these public circumstances. I don't know. It's just very, very strange. But anyway.
It's almost Pavlovian because they know they'll get something good out of it if they have bad behavior. So they continue to do it. Like, it's almost as if a toddler was never taught never to have tantrums in public. They could just continue to do it into their adulthood.
Possibly, but I think it is disappointing to see, I think what Ariana was talking about, the shift of people who acted totally reasonable until they started expecting a certain level of privilege, and then that became normal, that was the level of privilege that they were expecting to be catered to.
Yeah.
And that's just something that I just think is, I mean, you would hope that it wouldn't happen to anyone, but I don't know, it's just the fact that it does happen so often, because no one, unless they're, you know, Prince William or something, is born like having, you know, few people are born into a high amount of privilege unless you're from a very rich family or something like that. And I think Ariana, one of the things we were talking about when we were in LA is noticing the shift between privileged children who are raised by nannies who start out loving the nanny as a parental figure, and then as an adult start treating her more dehumanized, all sorts of things like that. And I'm just like, how did we get here? There's so many terrible examples, but I don't know. Yeah, just slow down. Think about
whether
you're being...
Let's move on to other terrible things.
Yeah, slow down. Think about whether you're being a reasonable human being. And I don't even know. Mitch, do you want to go next or shall I go next?
I'll go and I'll let you follow it up with something better, because I can never follow up yours with anything half decent.
Oh, that's not true.
It is, Natalie. Come on. You're great. So mine is kind of an old horse I've been backing probably for around, maybe 10 years. Whenever video games started to really get strong into this term DLC, downloadable content. And what it means is simply that it used to be you were getting additional things that were like a gift, something awesome, something you'd want. I don't know. Like if the game was already full, for instance, and you wanted like a cute new costume, or if you wanted a fun new weapon or a brand new level that they developed because the game became really popular and they were like, okay, the fans want it, we'll give them more. DLC has kind of translated into what's called a microtransaction, which is a form of highway robbery, because it comes to the point where a game will release on day one with this DLC, with these new levels. And that's probably the biggest thing here, that you're not getting the full content for the game that you're paying. You have to pay like sometimes like $15, $20 more to get additional levels that very much could have come out on day one, but they know that they can make money on them. So the business model has become, don't give out the free game, make them buy additional stuff. And it just doesn't make sense day one. Like even if you have it developed and you want to save it for extra, save it for later. It's kind of like a culture thing that it feels wrong to do this to people, because it kind of feels like a kick in the face. Like you spent $60 in America on this video game, and you've waited years for it to come out and you're expecting it to be great, but we're going to pull the rug back a little bit because you're not going to get the full thing. And I'm assuming this can kind of translate into anything else that people get into, any other form of media, perhaps like DVD extras, if that's a thing. Like I'm sure we could talk about even like waiting to have like an unrated cut of a movie just so you can see the scene you wanted to, or deleted scenes to that effect that weren't in the movie theater. You can only see on DVD. So it's kind of like a pull in to get them. And I'm even then too, within TV shows, I'm allowed the same rights with like their DVD box sets or anything else of the sort. So, that's my soapbox and how I feel about it. I know, Natalie, you were saying like, this is so out of your realm, and I understand that.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I mean to varietize the conversation and to, open up your world, Natalie, because you said you didn't know much about it. I was like, all right,
that's fine.
We'll try it.
That's fine. But you need to break it down more than this. I literally have no idea what you're talking about.
I've never played a competitive video game. I've only played Rock Band. So I really don't know what you're talking about.
You're going to need to break it down into some sort of metaphor, because I just literally, like, your point of entry is too high for me, basically.
Got it. Okay, so a metaphor would be you – it's going to seem really strange because it is. You order a pizza, and on that pizza – is pepperoni in the picture, and when you order in everything, you expect that pizza to show up with pepperoni.
It's a supreme. It's got all the toppings.
No, I'd say even the opposite. It comes just cheese, because even though you ordered a pepperoni pizza, it's only coming cheese, and then they show up last minute at your door saying, I have this pepperoni to give you. You can only get it if you pay more money. So you went above what you expected to pay already.
So after you already paid,
yes.
And they're like, well, you okay. And the pizza guy shows up at your door and he's like, okay, have your pizza. Oh, but wait, I have the pepperoni still in my pocket.
Doesn't it seem so strange? Because it is.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, I've never played a game either, but I'm still like, do you not just buy the disc and then it's everything is there? Like, or are
that
you talking
should be the full pepperoni pizza. Yes, it should be, Natalie.
I don't know.
But you're saying that technically how it works, you just download it online and it updates, like it patches to add in that content and add in those levels. Like usually it's just like a new adventure, like a cute new time of beating more villains down or what have you.
Okay, all right, okay. So what you're saying is what it used to be is you could pay extra for something genuinely cosmetic that's an extra, like that you could pay extra to do something totally – okay. It's like I'm building a house and I could pay extra to paint my house bright pink. But I still got the whole house. It was just white. And I could pay extra to pay a bright pink. Now you're like, here, I've paid for the house, but it doesn't have a bathroom.
Pretty much.
Is that the like, kind of metaphor that you mean?
It's pretty not much, like, because it's like... Yeah. It's kind of like something you would expect to come with the money you paid for something not being there.
Yeah, as in like, say the game is 10 levels.
Yes.
You would expect it to get all 10 levels at once.
Yes.
For the base price, and it no longer does that.
Correct. It's a very common thing. It's kind of like you... Yeah.
Yeah, that is something bizarre. It's kind of like, oh, I've bought the DVD of Supernatural season 13, and it only goes up to episode 17. And if you want it all the way to episode 22, you have to pay extra for another disc that wasn't in the box when you bought it or something like that.
But sometimes, you don't know, sometimes those extra 5 episodes were filler. They didn't matter. They weren't canon. So it's kind of a risk and a stupid thing at that, because it's like they're dangling the carrot in front of your face. Like, do you want to buy more things? And you do. And you're like, that was stupid. That was not worth the $20 out of the $60 game that I bought. That was like a half an hour of new content compared to the 20 of the full game. How was that $20 is the idea.
That's all. That's very bizarre. I don't really understand these not open source, but these like, choose your own adventure situations of like the amount of things that you can add on. Like, I don't know. Like, I assume that you're talking about what would happen if you went to the shop and bought it in a physical form, like a cartridge. Is that still a thing?
Of course, yeah. It always should be a thing, in my opinion. That's another discussion for another day. But it's still going to be the vanilla-based game minus the pepperoni. it's always going to be that. And I don't see it getting any better. It only ever gets more and more worse. The reason I'm seeing it right now is because I'm intensely playing the Spider-Man video game that came out for PlayStation 4. And it is amazing to me that there's still extra content above this because there's so much that I can't see it being worth paying for the pepperoni at this point, the DLC. I don't know what more you need to satiate yourself, but if there was stuff that they felt you needed to satiate yourself with, they should have kept it in the day one game. They shouldn't have made it the pepperoni to buy. They shouldn't have made it the DLC. It doesn't make sense. It's really just highway robbery, and that's all it comes down to. It's like, hey, you like this thing a lot? Well, we're just keeping a little bit of it from you so we can extort it up really high. We can make it more expensive than it ever should have been.
That's very bizarre. Is it parts that stop it functioning? Like, is there
No. Like, so it's not the bathroom really missing. It's just, like I said, the pepperoni.
Okay. I don't know.
It's just extra. It's like bonus. It's the cherry on top. And often the cherry is sour and rotten and not worth it.
Yeah, it's playing with, like, FOMO. It's playing
even self-FOMO, like, you don't need to know that everybody else played it more than you. You want to know that you got the ultimate experience. You got all that the storytellers wanted you to get.
I don't know. I understand so little about any kind of games that I don't really understand why they would do that. But
it's a business model to just make a lot more money. And, you know, I think even you said, Adiana, you played Rock Band. Imagine buying Rock Band and it had like 50 songs on it. But then they were like, even awesome. They're like five awesome songs that you could buy day one, but they weren't included with those 50. And you were like, I just paid for the full game. I don't know why you left the five best out of it. So shouldn't that be in it?
It's like an expansion pack, like back in the day of CD-ROMs. It's like, oh, The Sims expansion pack. Yes. You know,
in a way, but not as large. That's the thing.
And you're saying that they release it not even as, oh, we've developed something extra.
Yeah, like because the fans liked the game so much, we developed
it. It's not like, oh, you know, version 2.5 because we've built more in the meantime. It's, here's the base level and here's the gold level that you can also buy that's more.
Yes.
I don't know. That's kind of strange. Yeah, I don't know. I'm sorry about that.
I mean, I survived just fine because I refuse adamantly to buy DLC until it's like very specific to, like, we developed it after this game was popular. We realized how popular it was. We gave in to fan demand and we were almost forced to make this. Not we did this to extort people and we gave it to them on day one. Like, sometimes I buy a DLC that's like 2 years after a game came out because then it expands my experience that I've had for 2 years and it feels worth it. Not the brand new experience I'm having on day one.
I understand the difference. The difference for sure. Very odd. Again, it's like complacency all over again. Like, it's the same issue, but it's the issue of people's expectations of what is normal changing.
Indeed.
I'm sorry.
I'll survive. I'll be fine. It's very much a first world problem. I have to say that out loud. It really is.
Yeah, it's definitely, yeah. There's a lot of things that we've got used to that are just such a fast development of how we live changing that is just boggling, especially if you're in the generation of people who were both pre and post internet in every home, if you know what I mean. The people who grew up having always had the world of the internet being normal is very different, but I am in the era of people who has a clear memory of pre-internet life, like pre-internet schooling and like that kind of thing, and a post-internet world. And I feel like that for that changeover period, like, everything's just going to be weird forever. And I don't know I don't really know what the new normal is because I'm still thinking about the old internetless, cell phoneless world. So,
If you basically, if you were like 10 when AOL became popular, I think that's what crowd you're referencing, the one that was in and out of the internet. But then right below that age group where you always had Facebook in your life. Yeah, it is weird because I can only imagine how weird it is for our parents to look down and see us in that hybrid, let alone for us then to look down in the complete form of always having internet.
Yeah, I graduated school in 2003, which is, the internet existed, but it was not like a part of like schooling, if you know what I mean. It was not a massive part of like, it wasn't an expected research tool or educational tool or like, you know, our stuff at school was still handwritten, you know, that kind of thing. So it's been a real shift in our lifetimes, and it's all very odd. But anyway, so my gripe is something that's been just weighing on me recently and always has, which is just regarding my mental capacity and how much it's diminishing, to be frank. I've had a lot of health issues recently with deficiencies in vitamins that I've had to get like supplementary infusions for and stuff because it's deteriorated so much that my mind is just like forgetting things or not making the right kind of like word connections and all kind of things. And it's like B12 deficiency and a variety of other things. But it sort of hammered home as well that I am never going to be able to learn and become fluent in Hebrew, which is the language that my entire family, aside from me, speaks, because my father is a Israeli immigrant post-World War II. He's the only one that lived in Australia, like the rest of them are all in Hebrew-speaking countries and came from Eastern Europe in the World War II. My older brothers speak it. My younger brother learnt it at university, but he also learnt, you know, he's learned in my lifetime like four different instruments, and he taught himself to draw and stuff like that. He just has a memory for pattern-based learning, you know, and that kind of skill that I don't have and have never had. And it's just getting very depressing and frustrating because I was not allowed to learn Hebrew as a child because I had one parent that was a native English speaker and one parent that was a non-native English speaker, like my dad, who spoke Hebrew. And despite what they have allegedly discovered, that, you know, learning multiple languages at the same time is actually good for children's minds, at the time, my mother thought it would be like confusing and difficult and that I would not advance in English if I was speaking two languages at home. And so we were never taught Hebrew as children. And my brother learnt it at university. My younger brother learnt it at university because he had the skills to do it. But I have never been able to learn patterns like that. And I'm all right at learning by ear, it's like music as well. Like I can learn by ear. But Hebrew is a different alphabet. So the like even if I learned it by ear, which I know many words and, you know, vocabulary and stuff in Hebrew by ear, the written alphabet being different is not within the realm of capability that my brain ever had and has even less now. And because we're in such a text-based world, you know, we're in a WhatsApp group with, like, my family, like all my brothers and my nieces and nephews, my, you know, father and stuff like that. And all it is all day is, like Hebrew language, you know, keyboard typing, and I am the only one that is excluded. And it's just very depressing, basically, and it's been upsetting me a lot recently, and I don't know how common this is for people who were, you know, in a bilingual household to have children who are not bilingual, but it's very miserable to me. And at the moment, because I'm having so many struggles even speaking English, the realization that it is never going to be a capability that I have has been very depressing. So that is a gripe and a half from me at the moment. So, yeah, I don't know. Mitch, you don't have any immigrant family, do you? Like any second language at home?
If anything, it's two generations up. My grandparents grew up speaking French and then learned English from Canada. Both of my grandparents were French Canadian, my mom's side. Not both sets, but my mom's side.
Yes, your mother's family was French Canadian.
Correct. Yeah. Right. But my mom said kind of the same of what you've been speaking of, that she hasn't really had to really speak French, and she doesn't really feel left out. I think she's gotten past that point to where everyone just speaks English enough that it doesn't have to matter. But there, I mean, I'm sure that we have some Canadian relatives that we simply don't talk to because they speak French and we don't know how to speak with them. Well, but go ahead.
I was going to say, did your mother learn French at home growing up?
I asked her this somewhat recently, and she said that they did try and speak English mostly at home because they did want them to have the best chance in America. Uh-huh. Because my grandparents, as I understand, were like born right after my great grandparents came to America. So born on American soil, I suppose, but still of French Canadian culture as it is. They wanted to make that different. They wanted to make sure that in their eyes, you know, whatever it was back then, that their children had the best opportunities possible by speaking English. I don't think that would have been as big of a deal if they learned French and English at the same time. Or maybe there was some form of ostracization that I don't understand because I'm not of that time period. I don't know. I don't think, I don't know how America was back then toward both languages. But what you said about WhatsApp, it brought to my mind, would there be an app that would translate automatically while you're talking to people of different language? That would be kind of cool. Like in the chat even, not even like you have to search it.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like that it shows up for you in an English translation.
Right.
I don't know, maybe, but it is depressing. A part of it is that a lot of the children are, like, the oldest one is, like, 13, 14. And they only start learning fluent English, because English is mandatory at school there. But they only really start getting a grasp on it, you know, probably in the teen years, and some never really get a grasp on it. Though ours hopefully will. So, you know, a lot of it is that they, you know, they can read it. But my brother, like my sister-in-law makes an effort, but my older brother, one of them, just never tries, like at all, to speak English. And I feel bad being like, oh my God, like, you know, I'm the one with the lacking quality, like everyone catering to me. But it is depressing to be excluded when most of them can speak English as well in that circumstance. Just it's really miserable, though it is a flip side reminder of, you know, many people's attitude towards not speaking English in English speaking countries. But this is just like a personal disconnect from my family that has been so depressing. And like, because I feel ashamed having to ask to be spoken to in English or to remind people to switch conversation to English, even in person, but with writing it's impossible. But I don't know, Arianna, I was curious about your family at home, and like, because your whole family is bilingual, is that right? Like
it's what gender?
Oh really? Yeah, so I'm curious to hear like that circumstance.
First of all, it is very common here as well, or it was, not so much anymore. Now everyone's backtracking now that we have better scientific information. But in the past, new immigrants really encouraged their kids to only learn English, especially like when my mom was little, and like sometimes they would get in trouble if they spoke Spanish and school,
from their family or at school?
From the school. Oh. So just in general, like parents, a lot of parents try to have their kids only speak English, which obviously gets harder when your kids are fluent in English and you're fluent in Spanish, and it creates more miscommunication problems. My family, though, is a little different in that for my mom, it was really important that her kids speak Spanish, and she's a dual immersion teacher. So she teaches
as
part of a program where she teaches Spanish, but I'm actually the only fluent grandchild. My brother and sister, they speak it as what we would say pocho, like, which means like they can get by more, like they can understand everything and they can get by, but their grammar isn't perfect and they don't always know the right word, but they can get by. I'm the only fluent one because I was the oldest, and so I spent more time with my grandparents. Mm-hmm. But all of my cousins, none of them speak Spanish at all. They all only speak English. And I know it is, like, I'm just going to flat out say for all of them, because mm-hmm. I think they've all felt it. There has been, like, some shame associated with it, and definitely I think some regret, because they can't communicate with our grandparents in the same way. Like, mm-hmm. I have a very familiar relationship with them because I can speak to them in their own language, but
yeah.
because they, especially because they're old, like, there's the double barrier of, like, the generational gap and mm-hmm. then the language gap, I think. It makes things yeah. harder for them.
You have more chance at connecting with them as two adult humans who have different stories to share and stuff like that, as opposed to just kind of a not really a genuine conversation tool, you know, like with the language barrier.
I had to say two things because you guys both reminded me of things in my life. And one is really funny for you, Natalie, that I needed to say, and also for you, Ariana, that I don't know what the context was because my mind is doing the same things, Natalie. I'm forgetting how to speak English at times right now. I think, as I'm telling you, it's like an insomnia issue. But I was talking about Game of Thrones, which I still do not watch, to a friend. And I was trying to find the word incest and I couldn't. I literally couldn't think of the word incest to describe them. And I was like, what the hell? It was really, it's like a very bizarre moment when that kind of thing happens. And then also I should say, like, from my parents down to myself, while my mother wasn't able to, or would ever want to, I guess, really teach me French, she and my father were always really encouraging to have us, like, intensively take Spanish to, like, a college level in high school, because, I mean, I give them credit because we were in a small town of completely English speakers in upstate New York, but they always understood, like, if you're going to learn a language, you should learn one that's very popular so that you can have more experiences in the world. Probably like Spanish or Chinese, they would have always encouraged, I'm sure, if Chinese was also offered in my class of 55 people. But all I had was French or Spanish, and I ended up choosing. See, it's funny, like, my mom could have guided me toward French, you'd think, for like a pride or a generational thing. But I think it was just sort of like a natural progression for a lot of people in my life, even. It was kind of like a cultural thing, like, you need to learn Spanish, at least at, like, that basic level. And I don't know if I'm anywhere near the level that your siblings are, Ariana, but I'm still the same. Like, I can, like, get along in Spanish conversations if I need to or understand most contexts, but I have a lot of wrong grammar. And it's not, like, really speakable anymore. I used to pick it up well, but I think I'm with you, Natalie. Like, I think my ability to pick up new languages or remember ones I've learned are going to diminish if I can't even speak English in the first place. Well,
learning new languages as an adult is really hard. The first time, I've only tried it once. When I was in college, I took a semester of French, and I was like, oh, this will be easy because it's so similar to Spanish. It was so hard. I only know one word, and I can say the black hat. That's all I can say.
It's interesting because I don't know, it's certainly harder as you get older. For me, obviously, Hebrew is a really niche language, probably even less than in America because you guys have got a fair amount of Jewish immigrants in America. And that being said, a lot of the places that teach Hebrew are very religious. Like, it's like part of you know, Jewish studies, which isn't necessarily why I'm interested. But Australia has, like, tiny population of Jewish immigrants, like Hebrew speaking immigrants, like, so small that Judaism isn't one of the top, like, is not one of the selectable religions on our census. You have to write it in. If you when I you know, when you do the census, if you want to declare a religion, Jewish isn't in the top top options that are there as a ticky box. You know, you actually have to write it in because it's that much of a minority in this country.
Oh, you mean that thing I usually write the force in?
I guess. I don't know. But I've had to do two censuses, I think, in my lifetime as like an independent adult. And yeah, I remember that. And so there's very, very few opportunities to learn it here from a teacher. But I'm remembering, because I did a few languages at school, it is kind of compulsory in younger years to do some sort of language learning in Australia. And then as you go into older years in high school, it becomes more of an elective. Chinese is pretty common here, like Mandarin, because we have so much connection to Southeast Asia here, like so many Asian immigrants and so much like trade, like business trade with Asia. They used to do Italian as a very common one because before we had those Asian trade connections and immigration in the 70s and 80s, we had so much Italian immigration from the 50s and 60s. So there's a lot of like second and third generation Italian people here. I did Italian for quite a few years because it was one of the ones offered in the school. I did French for 2 years in high school as well as Italian, like them both at the same time. And I've learnt the fact that memorizing meanings of words is not difficult for me. Like I can list off, you know, quite a lot of Italian or French vocab words, or if I like read the back of a packet that's only in French, like an ingredients of like, you know, some imported chocolate or something, I know most of the words on a list. Not most, but like basics of, you know, household things. What I've come to realize is my struggle, because I took years and years of language and I took years and years of music practice. I can remember facts and lists and definition. I cannot remember patterns. So I could remember words, but I would never have them fluently enough to pull together a sentence, like even a basic sentence, like the structure of how you would say it in a conversation. Isolated words, and in Hebrew, isolated words I know quite a lot of as well, but I don't know the alphabet. That's a totally different story as well. But the fact that I don't have any of that pattern learning, and apparently never did, makes me think that it's really going to be impossible. And so that's very depressing. And yeah, I was just like sending a screenshot of like our WhatsApp group, just like, you know, like pages and pages and pages and pages of untranslated like Hebrew chat between everyone except me, and it's very depressing and yeah and horrible yeah and just it just very hard to find a way to actually get to know people outside of them just, you know, I know for a fact that you're my niece or you're my aunt or whatever. It's very difficult to actually have like a conversation that takes that relationship into like a friendship, and it's depressing. But yeah. Yay.
Yeah. And I can only imagine Hebrew is a very difficult language to write by hand. I was just looking up pretty Hebrew writing because that's what came to my mind first, I guess. And it looks like it takes forever to do. Oh my God. I can't imagine. So I guess that's why everybody on WhatsApp is talking, as opposed to, I'm sure it was tougher to write letters and whatever else, but
yeah.
I don't know. It makes me feel like by comparison that English and Spanish and French, that they're easier languages to write because of their alphabets, as opposed to the Hebrew alphabet. Looks like it's a lot more complicated than that, but this is coming from an outsider, so I really don't know.
I mean, anything with another alphabet is harder. Spanish and French and Italian all have a Latin root. And so English draws a lot from that, though it draws some from Germanic as well.
Right.
There are definitely easier languages to learn if you already speak one, but it is still difficult depending on the circumstance.
Right, because you're not coming at it just from the level of learning the new language. It's also learning that whole new alphabet and teaching your hand how to do like new symbols that are just so like you could easily write anything in the alphabet without thinking of it. But if you had to learn a new alphabet, as I tried to do with Chinese, there isn't really an alphabet. There are just a lot of characters. That was like expert level language learning, and I was like, I'm kind of baffled at times to learn that English is sometimes the hardest language, it's said by many, because I still feel like Chinese or many Asian languages must be so hard to at least write. Because
the reason English is hard is because it has so many deviations from rules.
Yes, and that's the reason it definitely English does. Is hard for I feel that English. On a daily basis. I think we all do.
Yeah, English is the most mashed together without a true root, and that's why it's harder than others. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, I can only imagine from an outsider's perspective learning English, because it can be very messy and odd. So if we're finding things like Chinese and Hebrew so difficult to get into, imagine having to learn our complicated bastardized language. That doesn't sound fun.
I've asked my father, like, whether he, like, dreams in English or not. Like, whether, you know, if he has, you know, literally a dream at night. Like, whether he is, like, whether the people are speaking English or Hebrew. And he says it's English most of the time, but he has lived here for, like, nearly 40 years. But, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm always curious about
when it changes.
I mean, it's almost like an accent thing. Like, you almost wonder when someone loses their accent if they lived somewhere enough. And also, like, where their thoughts are, like, where their logic and their day-to-day thoughts are, like, what language they're speaking, not even just unconsciously when they're asleep. But I haven't even thought of that level, Natalie. That's actually really interesting that you would think to ask that in the first place, because, yeah, I never would have thought of that.
I don't know. I didn't know that you were in the only one of your generation in your family that was fluent in Spanish, Ariana. Is that, like, I mean, it's fine for you. Is it frustrating? Like, do people have you translate a lot within your family?
Not within my family. At work, often.
Yes. Yeah. I know that at work that you have. So most of the people of your generation of Latino background that you meet are not fluent, or they are fluent?
It really depends more on which generation you are. I would be, it's kind of complicated. I guess I would be second generation born here.
Okay.
And it's pretty rare for me. So, like, my grandparents were fluent and my parents were born in the United States.
Yeah.
So they're fluent in English and Spanish. And so it's pretty common, like, so they spoke only Spanish at home because their parents only understood Spanish.
Yeah.
So it's common for the first generation, which would be my parents, to
be fluent.
Fluent in both languages. But it's very, very rare usually for, like, the second generation, which would be me. They usually don't speak Spanish because, like, my parents spoke English to me.
Yeah. No, fair enough. It's just interesting, and it's interesting how it's changed in terms of the scientific ideas about development, because my father has, like, a family friend who's another Israeli guy who lives in Australia, and their children are learning at home English and German and Spanish. Like, it's the parents speak English to each other because it's one German lady and an Israeli man, and then the children speak all three. And it's just, I mean, it's good that people are doing that, but I feel quite resentful of my experience. Yeah.
Well, like, now people are making more of an effort. And, like, that's really what it takes if you're immigrating from anywhere. If you want to keep some part of your heritage, it does take effort. Like, my cousin I think she thinks she's more fluent than she is, but she's really not fluent at all. her son sends him to a daycare with a woman who speaks Spanish, so he gets Spanish all day. So I would say her child is fluent. Her 3-year-old is fluent, but she is not.
Mm. Yeah.
That's like a unique generational gap that I now understand a lot more with you having described it, but I never would have thought of having happened before. Interesting, actually. Like, it's almost like I didn't learn enough about my culture, my language, but now I want you to be able to, so I'm giving you an opportunity that I never got, in a way.
Yeah, and there was also the scientific misapprehension. That's the thing. I think there was a, like, in terms of not just like which generation of immigrant that you are, which is a factor, but I think that there was a time where, you know, medical or developmental, educational, like pedagogical ideas were influencing parents one way or the other, especially when it's bilingual, like when one parent speaks another language and the other doesn't, because as opposed to two people speaking the same language to each other at home. Because my parents would have only spoken English to each other because my mother didn't. Oh, she was, like, she did actually speak Hebrew for a while, but not, you know, only as a traveler and stuff like that. And yeah, you know, made the conscious choice to not have my father speak Hebrew to me. So I don't know. It's all very strange, but anyway, let's move on to nicer things. All right, Ariana, do you want to go first? I'm curious about both of yours. I'm more curious about the Downton Abbey one because I know I have no idea what the debate is.
It's not really a debate. It's more just like a thing that nobody agrees with except me and probably you. But so my first hype is I really want to hype up the Good Place podcast. Mm. I'm sure some, oh, Natalie, you've seen The Good Place.
Yes.
I love The Good Place. I really do think it is the, I want to say most, definitely the most ambitious, and I think the most creatively fulfilling comedy that's mm-hmm. out right now.
Yeah.
But something that I started recently listening to The Good Place podcast, and I binged mm-hmm. it, and I was having a very depressing week this week, and, but listening to it made me feel a lot better because I really appreciate, so in the Good Place podcast, they basically every week they go through an episode, kind of like rewatchable, mm-hmm. go through an episode of the show with one of the actors and someone behind the scenes creatively. So either like a writer or a special effects person or somebody like that. And they talk about like how they make it. But something that I learned about it that is really interesting is I guess it had never really occurred to me how much thought they put into the ethics of the show and the for the creator and really for everyone on the show. It seems like the most important thing to them is making a show that encourages people to live ethically. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was so beautiful.
I heard a thing that the creator, Michael Schur, said, you know, he had like four questions about, you know, it's every episode, like, you know, is it funny and is it, did something, you know, achieve this? And then like the most important question is like, did it answer like an ethical question? You know, was it focused on like an ethical debate of some kind? And obviously that's kind of the surface narrative of the lessons, you know, that Chidi is giving in the show and the whole heaven and hell, you know, not quite heaven and hell, but whatever. But yeah, I didn't really know how deep like it went that's what they're kind of aiming for people to take away. Like, you know, The Good Place might be about ethics, but I didn't know it was for ethics, if you know what I mean. Like if that's what it's like trying to get people to feel or to think about. So I do like that.
And especially, I mean, considering my gripe, it, like for them, it's really important in terms of behaving ethically. Like the question is what do we owe to each other? Exactly. Yeah.
It is beautiful. Like it is, I cried. You're up to date with the whole series.
Yes.
The finale of season two, I think I cried the whole 25 minutes or something. Like I just completely, it is a hard hitting show. And I love that they make this podcast that is educational about behind the scenes of television as well, because I feel like every show should have one of these podcasts that gives people an insight into the realities, because you don't see people making drama about The Good Place, do you? You don't see people on Twitter having crazy fights about the meaning behind The Good Place, because they're out there being very open and explaining how it all works. And I feel like yeah. that maybe if more shows did that, there would be more of like a perspective on how it all works for everyone who watches it.
Well, I think it's safe to say that this podcast does that well. The after show TV show for the Walking Dead series never does that for either Fear the Walking Dead or regular even the Walking Dead. Because often what they do is they like kind of have, I don't even know how to describe it, like some kind of crazy cliffhanger or like some really strange character motivation or just a really bad plot. And they try to explain it away like it's legitimately canon and they needed to do it that way. When it's just like an excuse kind of thing. And then like, oh, we're just so awesome and amazing and we do nothing wrong. As opposed to like a behind the scenes look and describing how well structured their show is. You have to have a really good show before you go into doing this kind of after show.
I don't know. It's an interesting endeavor to take. And I've heard a lot of people say that that set is like a beautiful place to work as well. So hopefully they're, that message of what they're living on, what we owe to each other, goes towards everyone who works on the show as well.
I hope so. Because they did talk, one of the questions that the interviewer always asks is like, has working on the show made you think about ethics differently or like how you live your life? And everyone so far has said yes in terms of, and I even noticed like I do it too since watching the show. You know, you'll be like at the grocery store, like in a parking lot, and you'll think to yourself, oh, did I just lose points or am I getting, like, should I do to gain points?
Interesting.
You know, like thinking to yourself, what's the right thing to do?
Interesting. I don't think in the terms of points, but there is something that I'll talk about in a second, actually, because I was thinking about whether I wanted to do this as my hype, but given that you've spoken about it, I think I will. That has kind of done that, like looking for opportunities to be kinder and things like that. So yeah, like it is a really important show. And I love that this is the show that has got this fantastic resource as well about the makings of it, because it is asking bigger questions about, you know, it's very interesting to know the behind-the-scenes reasoning of any fictional world, but this is such a unique one. And despite the fact that the universe is just being so terrible all of the time lately, I love that this show has been universally adopted, and it gives me the idea that everyone, like, wants things to be better than they are, you know? Like, the fact that so many people embrace this show is representative of, like, that people want everything to be better than it is because it's so bad. Well, Arianna, you got to see their panel at Comic-Con as well. I did not manage to get it because it was a clash. What happened? What was that environment like?
It was fun. I'm glad I got to see it. Probably like did not need to have Leo wait so early.
Oh, well.
I'm very appreciative. But you know how like in the moment you're so excited for things and like reflecting on it 2 months later, you're like, wow.
That was not worth that energy. But yeah.
It was really lovely at the time. It had a great energy. The actors do seem like genuinely good people.
Mm. And,
from what everyone says, Ted Danson is the loveliest human to ever exist.
Yeah, I've read so many nice stories about him, like, just being kind and great and funny and, you know, bringing everyone together or, you know, it sounds so cute. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say two things. Once again, you guys just always remind me of great things. It makes me really happy. I love talking to both of you. Anywho, I wanted to refine my point on what I meant by after shows that are bad. it's kind of like the DLC thing, actually. It's kind of like you're missing the pepperoni with The Walking Dead's after show too, because sometimes you simply can't understand the show unless you watch the after show. So that's kind of bullshit.
What?
Yeah. It's so dumb, Natalie. Oh my God. It's totally a whole nother, this would be a whole nother gripe.
Well,
it absolutely would.
I mean, this is a totally different circumstance in that this only just started. It's more like rewatchable. It's not a video. It's just a podcast where they talk about each episode that's been made. But it's not like watch this episode, then tune into the after show circumstance. With this
or
one.
Else, basically. Yeah.
It's a bit of a deeper cut than that. It's not like, right. Oh my God, that was awesome. You know,
right,
it's,
totally.
It's a bit of a deeper, and like,
these were all
nerds about, yes. You know.
And what's interesting is that these have all been done after the second season finale. So they, like, when you went over the first episode, it was with all the knowledge of both the first season and second season. So it'll be interesting when the third season comes out and they start doing them week to week without knowing the end game of the season.
And then the other thing I wanted to reference was Armchair Expert with Dax Shepard, because he's married to Kristen Bell, who stars in The Good Place, and she is his first episode. And it is the most unique look into the relationship, because it's so damn
personal.
Is
that the one where they fight?
Yes! What? You've heard of it too!
I have, because she went on Ellen and talked about how awkward it was because they were fighting.
They were fighting because he was in an attic doing his recording where he wanted to do it, and he was building it up, and he had a bathroom that was somewhat near where they were, and the toilet was just there. I guess it wasn't quite a bathroom. It was just like planks of wood from floor to ceiling, and she was like, you had to put up a curtain. You had to put up something. I need to go to Michael's. This is really stressful, and he was trying to be like...
That's right. That's right. She wanted to go to Michael's, and he was on her way out to Michael's, and he was like, no, we have to do the podcast. Right now, we scheduled it, and she's like, no, I have to go to Michael's
and get a curtain.
It's a very, and then they kind of shift eventually. And he says this, he introduces his own podcast, but I guess I'm double doing the job for him because it's so interesting. He's like, yeah, it's really rough, and I didn't even want to release it, but I'm doing it so you can get a really unique, intense look at our lives. But then it does shift halfway through, he says, and we start to become very loving and kind, and you see a little bit more of how we work through things and how that's a healthy element. So if you want to know more about, like, Kristen Bell's personality, I have never learned more about that woman's life just simply from the emotions she exhibited in the entirety of that episode, from the anger to the love. It was a wild roller coaster ride, and I loved every second of it.
That's really funny, and I have a really funny connection to that that ties back, which I was almost going to put as my hype, but it's a bit niche. Like it's a bit niche, which is that I mentioned Jensen Ackles and his brewery. He and his wife, who are both actors, his wife was on One Tree Hill and has not been a working actor since they had children. She went back to work last year. She did a couple of episodes of Supernatural, and it's been 13 years. She was always like, no, I'm not going on the show. And then they ended up writing a part that she was offered and wanted to do. And she's great. I love her. But they did an audio commentary together, just them, a private audio commentary without like a host, on the first episode of Supernatural that she was in, on the DVD commentary. And that was very, very similar. Like, I really love her on social media. I really love every bit of interview that I've seen them do together for the brewery, and like they're very funny. They like constantly teasing each other and very like childish and funny and great. But this audio commentary was private, and so it was like, even though it was going out to the public, it was very similar circumstance of like, we're recording this alone in our place, so we're not like thinking about like the outside perspective of someone hearing this. We're just talking the way we do normally to each other. And it was very similar circumstance of that kind of relationship insight. They didn't really fight or anything, but they definitely like called each other out and argued, and a lot of insight into like what they prioritize and how they live at home and all that kind of stuff. But Dax Shepard, not related to the commentary, but related to something that happened with Jensen and Daniil on the internet to do with the brewery, Dax and Kristen, or, you know, maybe just Dax, and I don't know if Kristen will go for fun, want to do an Armchair Expert at the brewery with that couple about the brewery. So it's a interesting circular conversation there. So
oh, no, this is getting weirder. I'm looking up to get
that happens.
Natalie, I'm looking to get the link. for what Adriana was talking about, Dax Shepard and Kristen Bell's conflict. That's what the Ellen Show's video is. And then right above that is the podcast episode where Ellen DeGeneres is on the Dax Shepard podcast. And I'm just really, I feel personally attacked right now. This is a lot.
I've actually never heard an episode of this show of the Armchair Expert, but I saw this interaction go down about the brewery. So it's interesting. But wow. I was almost going to mention that commentary as my hype because it is my favorite thing that's happened in some time. It's above and beyond in terms of special content that I didn't have to pay the extra pepperoni price for. It's just there on the whole DVD. Really above and beyond in terms of comfortability and like and humor and genuine niceness. But it's a bit niche, but it's interesting that it would fit into this. But yeah, I don't know. I haven't heard the Kristen Bell argument. But I'm so glad that she has a show that I love her character in because I've never really – I like her and I haven't seen her in that many things where I loved her character. Like she's never made me feel that – like I always felt like she needed like a kind of character with a slightly nastier side to her. I think maybe because I first saw her in Heroes where she was quite a villain. And obviously Eleanor is kind of – I mean, she's not evil, that's the whole point, but she's not, you know, she's kind of a bit of a dick, and that's, whereas, you know, I've never quite liked seeing her play like a sweet hero, though I have never seen Veronica Mars, so I don't know how that all comes across.
Well, that's Veronica funny Mars, that I out think. Of all her shows, she wouldn't have watched the one that started it all.
I don't know.
I think she could. Kristen Bell could be 80 years old, and Veronica Mars will still be like the thing that she's always remembered for because it's such a. I think it's her most iconic character, kind of like how Ted Danson will always be Cheers.
Mm.
Like Veronica Mars, I feel like is Kristen Bell at her prime, I love her in everything.
Is Veronica a nice character?
Yes,
she's. A hero, but she's kind of mean.
Yeah, like is she as mean as Eleanor?
No, because Veronica wants to be good, but Veronica is like a Slytherin. She's like a Slytherin who wants to have a heart of gold.
Yeah, that's the thing. I feel like Kristen Bell playing any character that's not intrinsically a Slytherin doesn't fit for me. So that's good. Maybe I will watch Veronica Mars, but I've seen her be like very sweet and innocent, and there's just something about her that just doesn't work for me. But Eleanor is perfect because Eleanor is amazing and makes me cry and wants to be good as well. But it needs that kind of harsh edge to it for me with Kristen Bell. I don't know. I don't know if I've seen her in any movies. I can't remember. Anyway.
Well, I think you guys have really pinned it down for me, especially what you said, Adriana, about her being a Slytherin that wants to have a heart of gold. That is probably exactly why I find her very strange in Frozen. I mean, no, it's just a voice acting role, but it seems too sacred for my tastes for anything that I like her in. She doesn't seem authentic to the role. While like Idina Menzel plays like Elphaba Part 2, but it's just not, it doesn't fit Kristen's personality for her to be so nice and kind to everybody.
Who's getting a phone call?
It's me.
From
sorry.
2004.
Yes. I thought it was a Tamagotchi going off.
It's the old Nokia ringtone. Hold on a second. Sorry.
See, I was just trying to talk over it like I didn't hear it because I was like, maybe if I talk loudly, no one will hear the Tamagotchi.
I'm sorry. No, that's the old Nokia ringtone because all of the alarms on my phone, my current phone, which is a Samsung 9, are all just like too quiet. Like they're all just like very gentle, non-piercing sounds. And so I just downloaded that in order and put it on my phone so that I'd actually hear it. Anyway, I'm sorry about that. I'm definitely leaving that in the podcast because I love that reaction from Ariana. So anyway.
Anyways, it's weird seeing Kristen Bell in non-Slytherin roles because she's the Slytherin looking for a heart of gold. True.
Yeah, if we're done telling Kristen Bell like that she's not allowed to be nice, then then we can move on. But Ariana, I'm curious about the Downton Abbey, like what your hype is about Downton Abbey. That's a debate. Is this something? Oh,
we can just wait until, if we have time, we'll do it at the end. If not, I can save it for another.
Okay, I'm really curious.
As a hype and gripe.
Okay, yeah. Fair enough. Okay. I might go next just because I feel like what we're talking about lends into it very slightly in talking about how we treat one another and the ethics of the good place and all of that kind of thing. My hype is that I have just taken on a new role in my work life for the nonprofit charity organization Random Acts, which is a charity and nonprofit that does fundraising and various other things. Random Acts, as in standing for Random Acts of Kindness, which looks out for a lot of different opportunities, large and small, basically, to change the world for the better, like one random act of kindness at a time. And that goes from everything from, you know, doing little favors for people all the way through to funding huge life-changing endeavors for people. But I've been involved with this sort of tangentially for a while, and recently actually took up a job role there in the PR department, which is going to be interesting because I have not really... I was applying for a different role and was instead kind of offered this one or pitched this one, and it was a bit unexpected. But having kind of been working tangentially around this, or being, you know, knowing people who work there or being sort of involved in some of the events that they've done, has definitely increased that kind of, you know, gain points, lose points idea that you were talking about, Ariana, in just trying to be gentler with the world around me and more conscientious, not just in terms of being considerate, but in terms of looking for opportunities to help or to make situations better. And it's interesting because it has not just that, there's been other factors, but the more I kind of put conscious energy into it, the sadder and less resilient I get for people being harsh for no reason. And it's kind of like the more energy I put towards trying to be kind or trying to look for ways to help, the sadder I get about things I was probably complacent about before, about people being complacent or about people being harsh for no reason.
It kind of reminds me what you just said of the season finale of The Good Place, when she wants to be a good person and then she's sad when everyone else is still trash.
Yeah, basically similar. Like, a very small example, and this is not really something affecting, you know, real world change, but in the last few years I've made a real effort to not... And it's interesting experiment doing this podcast with the gripe section, because I've made a real effort to not publicly express hating things just for the sake of hating them, if you know what I mean. Like, if I didn't like a movie or a show or something like that, I don't just rant about why I didn't like it unless it's like an ethically questionable morality issue. Like, you know, so like no one should support Johnny Depp movies because that's bad. You know, like, you know, that's wrong.
Yeah.
I don't just go on and put energy into talking shit about something I like, because I feel pretty crushed by the idea of someone else liking something or me liking something and someone just talking shit on it even though I like it, or vice versa, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just noticing that I'm becoming more and more sensitive to stuff like that, like more and more sensitive to... Well, I might have thought it was normal to, like, scroll Twitter and see someone, like, ranting about hating something for no good reason, or, like, you know, mocking something. Now I'm just, like, very hurt by people doing that, and have made, like, a very conscious effort to try and not do it. And that's been something just over the past couple of years, not really related to this job. But it's just interesting, the more energy I put towards trying to consciously be more positive, the more depressing it is. Though I suppose that's not that nice to hear, but but is a very interesting shift away from complacency. And so going out to this job role is going to be a very interesting experience, because my prior day job, I was also at a nonprofit university, and it's definitely got to the point where I just don't think that I would, unless I really believed in the product being created in a corporation, I don't think that I would necessarily ever look for a role in a for-profit organization, unless it was like a creative industry where I believed in the art being made or something like that. You know, God forbid that, that being said, I don't have a ton of passions in terms of a day job that I need to fulfill me. So, you know, if it comes down to money, that's a different, totally different question. I'm certainly not at the luxury of not being able to do that kind of thing. But in terms of volunteer work, yeah, apparently, like, without noticing it, I have become a much more good person. And I just find that interesting to be the point at, I kind of find myself like applying for this role and being like, well, I don't even know if I have the experience or the energy or anything to do this, but I feel like that I need to. And it's just interesting that my sort of motivations have changed behind my back. In terms of how active as opposed to passive my effort to be positive and helpful has become. And I think that's a good thing, but yeah, it's just that sort of sensitivity about being kind and looking for ways to help has been such a driving factor for me for the last couple of years that it has apparently led to going after a job in that. So that should be interesting. Hopefully I don't overextend myself with my renovation as well as this, but we shall see. So yeah, that's a new thing for me that is only just starting, but it comes from that driving factor that we've been talking about of the world being very, very terrible and it being very, very depressing. But I don't know. It seems like that also trying to help is also quite depressing. So I'm not sure how to make this a full hype.
Can I ask, Natalie, why do you think that shift has occurred in recent years? Do you think it is like just due to age and being wiser? Do you think it's due to experiences you've had or a change in the world? Like, what do you think has made, what has, because we talk about this, the assistants at work talk about this a lot, like what makes a good person or what makes someone want to be good? What do you think has, because I've sensed a shift in myself, but what do you think has created a shift in you?
I think that there's just level of awareness of how much or how little one person's effect on another can matter. I think that there's just sort of an awareness of influence, an awareness of how much stuff that would have been thoughtless before can be harmful, or stuff that is, you thought was meaningless is meaningful, in a positive or a negative way. I've also had this happen in the sort of the physical world in terms of things like waste and like environmental. I am, you know, as conscious as any person can be about the fallacy that people are trying to make about, you know, climate change being fake and stuff like that, and how we're all doomed. But I have become really crazy about waste and about like ethical waste and stuff like that, as well as treatment of people and the world. And I don't know, it's just something that's grown, and it's always been there. To an extent, like, I don't think I was ever in a position where I was being like, you know, fuck you, I do what I want. I don't think I've ever had that, but it's kind of a growth in awareness of what someone can contribute and also in like what damage they can do. It's just a matter of realizing the power of your effect on each other, maybe, and that it's not all as isolated as you might think if you're being thoughtless. It could just be that I am more sensitive, like that things are just more hurtful or emotional for me now. I don't know. Like maybe that's just a development of the brain or the place in life. But I don't know. I don't know if it's a combination of that the whole world is just so terrible that everyone has been almost like rebelling against the terribleness, if there is a shift in that kind of attitude generally, like as in, you know, kindness as a rebel act, or, you know, because everything's terrible, it's become an aggressive attack of pushing back against the darkness as opposed to just assuming that someone else is going to handle it. But I don't know. I just know that things hurt me worse now. Like harshness hurts me worse now. And so I try not to do it in the opposite direction. And fear, maybe, like fear that things are not going to be okay. Exposure to the fact that other people's idea of like what's normal and what people have and can have access to is not actually accessible to them, like that people are in terrible conditions that I would have never dreamed possible because I didn't realize that their government, you know, allowed that kind of thing, you know. And I don't know if it's a reaction to the exposure of so much terribleness or if it's just the life, you know, life experience, no matter what. But it is different and, you know, it can only be a good thing, but I don't know.
I can say this. I think it's a good thing that you want to be better and that you're actively thinking of it. But also, I don't think you should be afraid to not like things because it doesn't have to be seen as a negativity thing. It can be strictly of personal taste, and that's fine. It doesn't have to come from a moral thing. It can be like, aesthetically, that show bothers my eyes. I literally still to this day cannot watch Care Bears because as a child, I used to swear that I could throw up because the colors were so gross to my eyes. I don't know why. It was you'd think it was like a gay thing, subliminally or something. No, it was just sometimes the color of the Care Bears really gross. I know, strange, and it's very niche. But like there would be really gross colors that they would like greens and purples and like oranges. They all were just very nasty palettes. I don't know why, but I hated the show forever, and I'll never like Care Bears aesthetically, simply not morally. And I'm fine with that. Like I'm fine never liking Care Bears. Be fine never liking your Care Bears, Natalie.
No, yeah. What I'm more talking about, Mitch, is the idea of not sharing unpleasantness just to be unpleasant.
Yeah.
Like if I didn't like Care Bears, I would just never mention them. I wouldn't be like, wow, Care Bears are so gross. They make me feel so sick. On a public forum where someone who loved Care Bears was like, who respected me and loved Care Bears was like, given a little punch in the face of shame, even though I wasn't directing my comment to them, it's still quite cruel to kind of be aggressively attacking something just because you don't like it in a space where other people might be upset about hearing something they don't like spoken about like that, unless it's for a reason that is sort of really moral. And, you know, we've had this kind of thing, like, you know, we've had arguments, you know, on, you know, Rewatchable and stuff like that about, you know, people, you know, like just not liking something and having like a discussion of why is fine. But obviously we've had some circumstances where people couldn't handle like hearing something like that. And I understand that, like, to a point. I think that we just need to be gentler about discussing what we, you know, discussing negativity, like, to what end. Obviously, on a podcast where the whole point is to debate the merits, that's a bit different. But just in life if I just start ranting about something I hate and that it's stupid, especially this attitude people have on social media of like, how can anyone think this is good? Like, that's just cruel. And that's something that I've really started being upset about, you know, along, you know, several years ago, but it just extends to so many, like a principle in so many other ways. But I don't know. The point is, apparently I now have a job doing things for a charity aimed at improving this kind of treatment of one another. So we shall see how that goes. Because I would not say I'm the most like sunshiny person, but I don't necessarily think that's what it takes. I think that it's, you know, you can be grumpily, you know, fuck you, I'm going to fix this, you know, kind of like, not that I'm all the way that grumpy either, but just looking for a way to be, yeah, to be kinder and bring people hopefully to that point of remembering each other's needs and looking for ways to help one another. But we shall see how that goes.
I'd say that you're perfectly sunshiny in your own Natalie way. You don't have to be happy to be like making others happy. It's not even going to be like always a comedic thing. Sometimes just like having a witty personality around is great because you can kind of snap back at each other in a good way, like in a constructive way that feels good. So I'd say overall from like an outside perspective, I think you're doing a great job being the kind of person you're aspiring to be.
Ariana, what you asked specifically, I think what it actually weighs down to is that I've always been a person who is, in my mind, or the best definition I've found of it, is utilitarian. Not in the kind of way that, you know, that sounds like, you know, very menial and robotic, but in terms of utilitarianism in ethics, which is believing that like the least harm caused is the best option. You know, if person A needs something 10% and person B needs something 60%, you know, then it, you know, basically doing what's fair for the, or the best quality of experience for everyone involved. And I've always sort of been like that without really being able to verbalize it. I think like there's just been more and more exposure to people, like more and more exposure to that the world does not really all feel that way. And that's been sort of shocking, but makes it me sort of want more people to be like that, in terms of like being considerate of the whole as opposed to not measuring up their effect or their needs against the global village or, you know, even the their personal community. I've been surprised at how many people and how much of culture is inherently inconsiderate, and I'm sure everyone is guilty of it, but for some reason it's been a really shocking adjustment for me in recent years. I don't know why, don't know what changed, but yeah.
Keep it real, Natalie, and you'll be fine.
We'll see. I already predict that I may get too upset about things and get burnt out, but we'll see. Anyway, we can move on to you now, Mitch.
Sure, well, to wrap up our show of our last hypes, even, I'm going to discuss the movie Thoroughbreds that stars Split and the witch's Anya Taylor-Joy. And I really like this movie because I think she has a good vibe in it, because she shows like a very honest interpretation of what this should be. And she always seems to do that in any film she's in. I refuse to watch Split because I can't get behind the concept of it, of I guess just villainizing a mental illness that's inherently very not good. But I hear she does a great job in that too. I was introduced to her in the movie The Witch. She seems to kind of like this horror or kind of gross out kind of thing is what she's into, but I like that genre a lot. So she's almost like, without a lot of the screaming, maybe some, but she's almost like a young Scream Queen to me. And I don't mean just of the Ryan Murphy show. I mean of like the Jamie Lee Curtis type the kind that could really kind of come up over the years and be in the horror world in a way that she was, that Jamie Lee Curtis was, and now is again with the Halloween reboot that she's about to be in. So I'm really excited because I feel like here I found something unique in picking out an actress that I see a similar arc in life in. And I know she has something coming up really soon too on the BBC that's another period piece just like The Witch. I'm very excited about that. But overall, the movie Thoroughbreds, on top of Anya Taylor-Joy's performance, has a couple of other really standout actors. This is the last movie that Anton Yelchin, to my understanding, had released of him. He is the Star Trek actor that unfortunately had died, 2 years ago because he was working at his car and for some reason it crushed him. So that was very sad and tragic. And he does a great job in his role here. He's kind of like a drug dealer man, but it's still, it's good. And another actor that drew me to this movie was Paul Sparks, who plays Claire's boyfriend in the House of Cards series. And he has like a certain, I mean, I hesitate to use the overused big dick energy because it doesn't even seem to fit in here. And it's just, that's almost like a je ne sais quoi at this point, if you ask me, but maybe that's what it always was. But that's what he is. He kind of has that je ne sais quoi that I like a lot too. He plays the stepfather in this movie. And the plot is that Anya Taylor-Joy is playing a character named Lily, and Lily is being convinced by her friend Amanda, who is kind of like sociopathic, to kill the stepfather. So basically the whole movie, Lily is being convinced by her friend, who has a very serious, like, non-emotional mental illness, to then kill the stepfather. And it's her exploration of that psychology behind it. So it's not as like schlocky and black humor as it could have been, but it still is. But the movie really goes into like, I mean, even they have a movie poster on IMDb that I'm looking at, and it says it pretty accurately. It's a quote from a review that says Heathers meets American Psycho. And that's probably why I like it so much, because it is. It's kind of its own weird masterpiece, and it's a bit of an indie film. So I think it's one you could have missed. But that's fine, because I think it's still worth getting into. It has a decent, it's like 83% in Rotten Tomatoes. It's a really well-made movie, and I had problems finding anything wrong with it. So that should say something, because I'm nitpicky as all hell, but it is a tight plot. It is a very tight plot. And the characters, like, everybody's acted very, 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 very well. It's a great cultural piece because it totally, like, knocks on the whole weirdness of rich, white, suburban youth and how they're supposed to get along in the world because they're so babied and it's weird. It's, like, not natural. And the movie is the whole time showing that these people are almost like alien creatures to any outside viewer, to have this much privilege and to have this much money, to look for reasons to excite your life because you're so bored because you're not going to have any problems, I guess kind of makes sense. It's kind of, do you remember the news story a while back that was about a man or a boy, I guess, that had like some form of manslaughter, but he got off the hook of it because he was considered to be too rich to understand problems, like right and wrong.
What?
I mean, that was an American news story that was out. Oh God, it could have been 5 years ago now. I'll find it. That's kind of what this movie goes into. It's like that concept and that weird part of society that is never going to fully be explained because it's so heightened. It's so crazy and it's so unrealistic and it's not unseen of. Like, this movie, it's based off of stories like that. It has to be, because it feels all very, very real. But I'm curious if anyone else has ever seen the movies I've referenced or is curious about this movie. I know, Natalie, I think you liked Anton Yelchin, right?
Yeah, Yelchin.
I think you liked him in particular before. Is that correct?
I did a lot, and Leo did a lot more, like a lot as well. Yeah, for that reason, I will 100% never watch this movie. Also, I just read the IMDb or opened it, and it said that a girl kills a horse, and I won't be doing so. I definitely won't be watching this movie for that as well. Part of that reason that what I was just speaking about for myself for a hype is it's also made me very sensitive to unpleasant media.
Like, oh, very intense.
I don't want to watch depressing things that don't have a happy, good moral ending. That's been a very big part of this as well for me. But
I don't blame you.
That being said, interestingly, what you mentioned reminds me of another movie that Anton Yelchin was actually in called Fierce People. and that was much earlier in his career. And it's also about one of those very, very rich families who, yeah, has a strange, you know, strange crime involved in it. And Chris Evans is actually the other, the Anton is the young kid in that one who's like brought into this world of insane excess. But Chris Evans and Kristen Stewart are the siblings, brother and sister. Yep. Who he meets, and then there's a crime and drug abuse and mental illness and rape and like terrible things, but it's all in this kind of same idea of privilege so high that they don't have social morals. So if you were interested in that film, you might like Fierce People as well. I don't know if it's quite as murdery, but it's pretty crazy.
Well, that's the thing. Like, this movie is like a weird soft R because its thematic elements are so incredibly dark and dastardly, but it never really gets language, violence, gore, anything. Like you think language, of all things, it would at least be able to swear. It doesn't need to, and it's really funny. Like, it's a lot of the old concept of classic horror movies. This one is not, but it feels like it has that element because it doesn't show you the nastiness of it all. It doesn't show you even the horse getting killed, which is great. But there's kind of like a moment, and I guess this is a fine scene to spoil because it's kind of like, I think it's a bit of the sell in the movie and it helps you understand it. There's a scene where Lily, the kind of good girl, I guess, in this movie, wants to see how Amanda had killed the horse. So she acts on an anonymous form for the pictures. You think the whole scene you're going to see the pictures, but you see her reaction. And somehow that's worse than actually having seen it because you never do. And that's the thing in this movie. It plays with your psyche in a beautiful way that should not be, Natalie, I understand, it should not be for anyone who's not looking for unpleasant material. It's meant to kind of like try and test you. Like, that's the whole feel of the movie.
Interesting. I don't know if I have the capacity to have anything that's not very nice and happy, yes. But I'm glad that you've found this and made it, you know, that you get some excitement from it.
Yeah, mostly just from how well it's made. And it's not often that I can just watch a movie.
I feel like I have heard of it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I don't know if I knew it was in the cinema, but I feel like I did. Maybe I just heard of it because of Anton, like it was the last thing that he filmed and it was like released after his death. Maybe that was why, but I don't know.
And if anything, like if the movie is something that you think you might not find palatable, Natalie, Ariana, or anyone listening, I would deeply recommend the soundtrack because in movie when they're playing songs, it's like they choose it from all sorts of like kind of tribal beats and like voices grunting. No one's really singing the whole movie in the songs in the background because everything is basically like the human mind breaking down, and the songs do it so well and they have a great beat. Like, it feels like even when they're at like a party scene, they still have that kind of tribal sound. They don't even go into like the typical teen party. They refuse to do this kind of schlock. They go right into like, no, this is deeper than that. You're going to appreciate this for deeper, and you're not going to find something like cookie cutter in anything we do here.
Yeah.
Like, they're earworms that you can't sing, if that makes sense.
It sounds like it might be stressful, but
it is. No, for sure is. Ariana, have you heard of this movie, or are you interested in anything of the actors or the movie itself?
I haven't heard of this movie. I was just reading the Wikipedia plot summary, so I'm going to finish reading that.
Do you enjoy entertainment that is stressful on purpose?
I really don't like, I don't watch any horror films at all. I don't even watch the trailers for them. Like, I can't, or I'll have nightmares. Like in Crazy Rich Asians, how they were showing the preview for The Nun before that. Like, what the heck?
Oh my
that's
God,
not
what?
The right, that's not a good matchup of
that's
films.
It's a bad audience match, yeah.
No. So I don't like that. And even like Searching, I'm weird because I really want to know like the story. So like I went and I read the plot of Searching because I wanted to know what happened, but I could not sit through 2 hours of that like intense, I don't know, unknowing.
So I don't like being stressed for fun in films, horror movies, or action. Action movies is okay. Gore, like the imagery, doesn't really bother me, but sometimes the anxiety does. I don't really like roller coasters.
The intention of a suspense behind it all.
Yeah, I'm more like anything that puts the body or mind through stress for fun is not very fun for me. Like, you know, like roller coasters, it's a physical option.
Right.
Though I like one or two at Disneyland, but not really not the big bad ones. You know?
Space Mountain.
Yeah, I've never been on that.
Splash Mountain.
I have been on Splash Mountain, but that doesn't go upside down or anything like that.
Still, that drop.
Space Mountain doesn't either. I would argue, because I also don't like any roller coasters, but I do enjoy Space Mountain. It just goes, but I don't like drops is the thing, and so it doesn't have any drops. It just goes in circles.
Mm. Oh, okay. Apparently the one in Europe goes upside down because Leo was very upset to go to Disneyland in California and find out that the Space Mountain was not as scary.
Oh, really?
So, I don't understand how they go on that one in the... Because I went to Paris. Europe and I was very upset to find out that it did go upside down. Mm. And also that it was not inside, like you were going in space. But...
It's very confusing. Anyway.
Doesn't it defeat the whole purpose of the ride?
I don't know what the purpose of any of the rides are because I don't like being scared. I like Big Thunder Mountain.
The Indiana Jones ride in Europe has nothing to do with Indiana Jones. It's just a roller coaster.
Really?
Yes.
That's very confusing.
Have you been on Indiana Jones in California?
I've been on the truck one in Disneyland.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's very fun.
Yeah. That's fine. That one's like you just drive through like a truck and that's fine. I don't know. Anyway, we can carry on.
What's next in our thing? Two truths and a lie?
Yes.
All right. I'm ready.
Okay. So Ariana has prepared two truths and a lie for us to guess about her life.
I really prefer being the guesser.
Oh, really?
The guessy.
Oh, have you got a guess?
I do. I do have them ready. I just feel like it's not very exciting.
I don't think anyone's very exciting, like in the grand scheme of things. Like in like what are we gonna, you know, what are we gonna say? Like we don't have anything thrilling to share. So that's fine.
Okay. So I'm gonna say three things. I've done two. Yes, that's how it works. I have ridden in a Venetian gondola, skated in Rockefeller Plaza, and climbed a pyramid.
The first one. The other two, I feel like I have weird memories of you telling me about them, or I've seen pictures of them. Like, I even think like I've seen a picture of you in a pyramid for some reason.
Well, I can tell you that I'm jealous if the Rockefeller one is true. Because I wanted to do that and the person I was traveling with refused. And
what?
I felt sad. I felt like it would be pathetic to do it on my own. But I always wanted to do it under the Christmas tree in Rockefeller. And the one time I went to New York at that time, the person I was traveling with was like, no, I don't want to do that at all. That wouldn't be fun for me. Can't you just do it by yourself? And like did not understand why I would not want to just skate around in a circle by myself. Like, and that a communal experience was like a factor of enjoyment. Anyway, that's a very...
You do these really well though, Ariana, because like everything seems so plausible. And when I do it, I'm like, my lie is always so obvious because I either talked about it too much before or it's just nowhere near the others. Like the others never fit thematically to the lie, but yours legitimately all feel like the extreme adventures of Ariana in the world. So kudos to you to coming up with a great theme there because it's more than I could have managed.
I'll ask you a question or two. Was the pyramid in South America or one of the Egyptian-type pyramids?
The pyramid was in Latin America.
Okay.
And oh, I've seen a picture of you because wasn't it during the Zula conversation we were having?
It was, yes.
Okay, I knew we talked about a pyramid.
Yes, I believe that that one is, you know, was something that I knew about. I'm not sure if you've been to Italy or if you have been to New York in the winter. I'm going to guess that the skating is a lie, unless it happened a long time ago, because you've never met our dear Brittany. And if you were in New York during the time that you guys knew each other, she would have come and stalked you.
So number two is Natalie's guess. What's your guess, Mitch?
Mine's number one, the in the gondola ride. That never happened.
Well, Natalie is correct.
Oh.
I have both never skated. I skated anywhere, and oh, I've never been to New York.
Wow.
Damn. I was super wrong.
You would ice skate with me in Rockefeller Plaza, maybe, instead of abandoning me, and we would both fail together. Or maybe not. I don't know.
Only if you were willing to hold my hand the entire way. But
yeah.
I am really bad. I've tried rollerblading. I guess just regular skating, and I'm so bad at it.
Four skates.
It's not fun for me at all. Even holding onto the wall, I fall, and it hurts.
It is actually a different thing. It's closer to inline, like rollerblading. Roller skating on a quad skate is what they do in roller derby. Leo has done roller skating nearly her whole life, both in like artistic figure skating, like on ice but on roller skates, and in roller derby. And she can't ice skate very well, but she can roller skate very well on the quad skates. The balance is really different. So maybe ice skating or rollerblading would be a different experience to roller skating, because it is, despite the fact that it's still wheels on your feet, it's a very different movement. And so maybe you can do one or the other, and that one you can't do, because I can't roller skate either.
I wonder if, like, do your feet feel less heavy to me? I think part of it is that the roller skates feel very heavy.
Yes, and you don't lift them. That's the thing. You don't need to lift them. Mm-hmm. Roller skating on a quad, you need to lift the wheel. You need to actually plonk your foot at some point. Whereas skating inline, like on a blade or rollerblades or an ice skate, you don't need to actually lift up the weight of your skate as much. Mm-hmm. So that might be it, but I don't know. One day we'll, you know, maybe one day we'll all experience that together.
Yeah, I'll never skate ever again. Sorry, I can't. It hurts. My ankles turn inward or outward, but they don't stay like centered because I don't have that balance. I never have. And also, as a child, I used to skate in the pond around my house, and I think I remember almost being good. Oh, yeah, there was a pond right next to my house.
Like a real piece of frozen outdoor water.
Totally, yeah. Because it gets down to like negative 10 in New York upstate when it's
winter. I've never seen real frozen water.
What? Oh, God, that's so crazy. I feel like I've seen it like every winter of my whole life.
I've seen ice rinks indoors, and it's real ice. It's not like plastic or something. But I've never seen a natural frozen water.
Nor have you ever had to tip in Australia. I am learning a lot of things about your life nowadays.
Yes. It's not like tipping is offensive. There's a tip jar at the counter of like a coffee shop or something, and you could tip after you leave a bill. But like, you know, say you got a haircut or something like that, or like, you know, like a lot of the services that require tipping in America, or like you took something to your room in a hotel, you would not have to tip the server. You know, like a room service or getting a haircut or a beauty salon treatment or getting luggage into a car. And you don't even have to tip after eating in a restaurant if you pay. You know, like it's not expected and it's not even requested. It's just a bonus. It's like they might buy themselves the restaurant staff might go in on a case of beer or something if they get, enough tips. It's not something that it depends on people's wage at all. So it's not as required. Yeah. And there's just many, many, many services that you tip for in America that do not even have that option in Australia that, you know, restaurant, there's certainly an option, but there's many, 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 many services where a tip is encouraged, where, you know, you have the price you're paying the shop, or the price you're paying your business, and the price you're paying the person who's helping you, like getting a tattoo or something like that, where, you know, that's money, untaxed money going into their pocket. Just doesn't exist here. You just pay the price that they tell you, and that's one price, and that's it.
Besides all things of tipping, anyway, and also within ice skating, the ending of that pond statement was simply people like to ice fish in that pond because it's pretty shallow and it's not really dangerous. You know, when it's freezing over all the way, it's so thick, like you can see the ice almost all the way down to the bottom of the water. That's how cold it gets. People would ice fish, and there was a time when my ice skate caught, like the tip of it caught in the ice fish hole, and I just flung forward at a pretty quick speed, and I remember as a kid just being so mortified and so like scared. It was a bad experience. But even in my childhood bedroom, next time I'm there, I'll have to take a picture of it because of this conversation. There's a picture of me, and I was only with two of my siblings out ice skating, I guess, that day. And there's a picture of me, like, I don't know, maybe age 7 or 8, just out there with my grandma. We're all through ice skating, and I'm all into all my winter gear, and I looked happy at the time. So apparently that was before the ice fishing hole incident.
Yes. That's all very way too much winter for my understanding.
So well, yeah, that's definitely upstate New York, and it feels like it never ends. Oh, it goes from like November until like April sometimes. It's grueling, and it's so cold. Oh God, like Fahrenheit, it's like negative 10 temperature degrees sometimes, and then you have like the wind chill, which can bring it down another 10 degrees to your skin. It's pretty like inhabitable. I don't really know why or how I've ever done it, but I always go back to visit every Christmas, and I'm always there, and it's always just as cold. So I never learned my lesson, I suppose.
It's still alien to me. Anyway, that's fine. You have fun with your snow. We have a question of the day to finish up from Andre at Hey, It's Andre. He says, have you ever been nervous to start a show because you know its fandom is toxic? Which is obviously, you know, depending on how engaged you are with other people who watch the same media as you are. Some people, you know, probably watch things without any outside input, so how the fandom is doesn't even matter to the quality of the show. But Ariana, have you ever kind of had this, like, been warned off something by the way of way people talk about it?
No, because I don't.
You don't care?
I don't, no. Yeah. I mean, like, I guess this... I am aware of fandom because I'm weirdly like immersed in it due to just everything we do, but I don't participate in it usually myself. Yeah. So I get to avoid this stuff. I know this I feel like this is a good question for you, Natalie, considering everything.
Yeah. I mean, I think it does depend on how affected you are by other people's engagement with whatever you're engaging with. If you like to talk to strangers about it, or if you just watch something and like it in your own terms, depends how much you want to engage. Yeah. And there's certainly been some for me. But Mitch, what about you?
It should have been Glee. I didn't know what fandom was before Glee. If I'd known, I would have stuck away from it because I don't know. Even toward the beginning, it wasn't so bad, but...
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, going into Glee, I don't think that's the... You know, that with warning sign was there necessarily at the time when you
not
started
season one,
Glee.
No.
No.
It was not until the Clean Jokers came along that it became the most toxic thing in fandom I've experienced. I don't know. I never really experienced something like that in Harry Potter or any of the video games I play.
Do you think that's also, though, because you were on a podcast that was for it? Because I feel like that's why. Because I also feel like I watched Glee and, you know, once again, like, immersed myself in it, but didn't, I guess, communicate with other people.
Mm.
Even if I didn't, I think, like you were saying, Ariana, being within the world of talking of fandoms much, it didn't have to be a podcast, just any work within fandom, I would have been aware of it enough to be like, because that is how I actively feel toward the 100 crowd. And I don't even care to talk about the things that seem toxic, because that's just enough aggro in and of itself to say, I don't care to get into that show. I have to leave it at that. That's how toxic the show can be to me. I love Alicia Denman Carey personally. I want to see her performance. I love her in Fear the Walking Dead, but I just won't watch her show. I can't. And I don't know if anyone else has felt that way toward that show or has been aware of it, but just for me, that's all I feel comfortable saying about the 100, which I think kind of speaks for itself, at least in my experience.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. That show has just never particularly appealed to me in terms of like post-apocalyptic ideas. But obviously Supernatural was huge, and obviously I watch it now, but I thought it was horrific before I watched it in terms of the behavior of the fandom that I'd heard spread. I think part of that is just the length of time that it was on air, but some of it, is true in terms of the amount of discord and stuff like that. But what I did discover upon, beginning to watch the show was that the vitriol directed at the contents of the show was not always as accurate as I'd heard it to be, as accurate as I'd heard the fandom say. Like, there was a lot of hate towards the people making the show for various failings and things like that, that when I watched the show, I was like, that is kind of not that in touch with reality, that hatred. But that being said, the behavior in terms of the way that people treating each other was as bad as expected, but with a side of goodness, a side of people, good people, and were much more demonstrative and open than I expected. I expected there to be a lot more gatekeeping and a lot more immediate negativity to basically anything. And the one thing about that fandom that proved that rule wrong was more than other fandoms that I've seen or that I've written like hyperbole articles about, they are open about being positive. Like a lot of fan engagement or any creator, actually, I've heard talk about that you often hear negativity or nothing. Like people don't go out of their way to be positive and express love for something, especially to the creator. It's either they hear a complaint and then people who are satisfied don't necessarily reach out. Supernatural actually reaches out pretty constantly to support like anyone involved or anything that they like about, like an article or someone's charity project. They're very, very, very positive, probably to the same degree that they are also very negative in other ways and other quarters. Obviously, every person is different, but there's certainly contingencies of both. So I was actually shocked by the kindness because I'd heard it was so bad. The other one, though, is not a show. It was a film, which was, and I've spoken about before, Star Wars. The perception that I had of Star Wars for 30 years or so was completely wrong, and that was based on, again, osmosis of what I thought was Star Wars fans, but clearly was a whiny contingency of terrible men who we've now seen go for a hard fall, where the entire Star Wars community of actual fans and creators have been like, you are ridiculous, after the fallout of the new films like Last Jedi and stuff like that. So Star Wars, I definitely...
What are they trying to do? Are they legitimately trying to remake a movie with the same actors? Is that their idea?
There are countless things, but I just think it hit a burning point, like it hit a boiling point of a contingency of Star Wars fans that always thought that they were the truest and most wholesome true fans being rejected at every turn by everyone involved in Star Wars, like, you know, Mark Hamill and Rian Johnson and everyone, because they were outing themselves as being like terrible, discriminatory, crybaby, obsessors about things that don't really matter, and that their idea of like being this pure and perfect Star Wars fan like was a total fallacy. You know, it's the same as, you know, any fan community where there's sort of gatekeeping of a bunch of strange men who've decided that this is for them and got totally the wrong message for it. But because Star Wars was so such a long, you know, enduring pop culture thing, and because then other pop culture would associate that behavior with it, I was put off from Star Wars for a long time because of what I'd mistakenly believed it to be like, not just the fans, but the actual content of the films. Then I watched the films and was like, that's not at all the message that I thought was meant to be the message. And I was happily surprised. But yeah.
Yeah, totally. That's a great example with the Star Wars fandom. I don't think that that's unique even to this day and age. I can only assume that while they do have their legitimate concerns about 1 through 3, there were things that they were picking at that perhaps should not have been. The actor who played Jar Jar Binks had come out and said that the fandom was so toxic toward him that he tried to end his life. So I think that even speaks to itself in this both being a very toxic fandom contingency back then and still now, and that especially that story came out recently, you know, like the fact that he felt the need to come out with that story amongst all of this new negativity should show us that this fandom's negative contingency isn't going anywhere. Maybe it's because it's so large. I don't know. I feel like Harry Potter, if I had to compare it to anything, doesn't have that large of a negative contingency, but
I'm sure it does somewhere, but
it's not, it doesn't feel, I mean, now with Johnny Depp stuff, it kind of feels actually large. Weird. It didn't really come out until recently, but never mind. Yeah. Maybe you just get large enough. Like, it's one of those live long enough to die a hero or become the villain things.
I don't necessarily think Harry Potter ever had that kind of Star Wars fanboy, like, I am the only one who knows everything about Harry Potter, and if you don't know this, you're not a real Harry Potter fan. And
really,
there's only,
because I feel like I'm one of those gatekeepers.
I mean, I'm very much like, I don't love the movies, and I feel I'm really surprised by people's attachment to the films. And like, when, like, I sort of only saw the films once as a repeat. You know, as, oh, this is the film version of the book, and that was it. But people's obsession with the films always surprises me. But I still don't think it's the same kind of misinformation. Like, even if you are a gatekeeper, Ariana, I don't think that you're giving people the wrong information about the contents of Harry Potter, you know?
No, because obviously everything I'm saying is right.
True. I'll allow you to say that. I feel like that's a valid, I can trust that from you. So that's fine. But I'm not sure. I tend to avoid, probably avoid that. Like, no, the question, have I been nervous to start a show because I know its fandom is toxic? No, I feel like I've already taken the, you know, the mother load with Supernatural, but I did avoid it for like almost 10 years because of this. Like, my friend Megan, who's been on this podcast once or twice, I think she first was like, oh, like, I know this show's a bit, you know, not quite right for your style, but I really like it. And then she's been on and off it for like 10 years. And I think the first time she messaged me about this was in 2009 or 2008, which was 10 years ago, like in probably their season 4 or something. And they're now going in season 14. So it did take quite a while. And I started watching it in like season 11, but I don't know if there's a bigger one than that. Voltron. No, I will tell you a lie. That Voltron. I have not yet watched Voltron. I hear it's amazing, but all I see from the fandom is crazy, crazy stuff about like ship wars and nastiness. And so, yeah, actually that would be the final answer. A show that I still have not watched because all I hear is negative behavior despite the contents is Voltron. So if someone can convince me otherwise, I'm here to listen. But that one looks up my alley and I have avoided it. So I don't even know what's going on over there, but it seems emotional. Anyway, that's all from me on that one. So I think that's everything that we have for you guys today. Ariana, would you like to read the high conclusion and then we'll finish up? I assume that you wrote this while we were doing this.
I did.
Cool.
Brittany isn't here, so we'll just have to wing it. We don't like research.
I mean, true. Well, thank you guys for coming on to speak to me, even though I'm forgetting, you know, 1 in 10 words and speaking very slowly, which is very depressing. Hopefully things will be better now that I've had some injections of necessary vitamins that my brain is meant to make on its own.
You gotta get them in somehow.
Yeah. Cool.
Good for you. I'm proud of you for taking care of yourself. Your words sound just great to me. Did you forget the word incest recently?
No.
Have you needed to use the word incest recently? Should be the real question.
No, oh God. Probably not.
Although I did on Friday at work because we were having this argument.
Oh gosh.
about the Lannisters. And
of course.
If they weren't brother and sister, would they have the healthiest relationship on the show?
I'm dying.
And is the answer yes or no?
I mean, we kind of came to the conclusion that in season one, kind of yes. Like,
yeah.
Of the adult relationships, theirs is probably the most healthy.
Yeah. I mean, they're very dedicated to each other and putting their family first, you know, but, you know.
I just love that I wasn't anyway, the only one in my life having conversations about the incestuous relationship of the Lannisters this past couple of days. It makes me very happy to feel of universal mind here.
Cool. All right. Well, we'll finish up and we'll see you guys later in a couple of weeks, hopefully with a little more grasp on reality. So, yes, until then, I hope all your woes become joys in some way.
That was great. That was like the ending to like a radio talk show program, like a feel good one, not like an NPR one, but like one of those like local ones that's kind of schlocky.
This episode was very like philosophical.
It was. I like it. It's like, we hope we helped you out with your relationship issues. Lannisters. For all you Lannisters out there, there is hope. Oh God.
Oh,
get me
God.
Out of here. Get me out of here.
Wait, this is over, isn't it? I thought no.
Well, we didn't say bye, but I can edit out the Lannisters. But no, I'm mainly just pointing at things and being like, hand me the blue thing because I've forgotten the actual word and stuff like that. It's pretty bad, to be honest. All right. Anyway, I'll see you guys later. So we'll say bye and Mitch can edit out what's necessary.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye. Is that just like the actual show goodbye or like the conversation and call bye?
Well, we didn't. Yeah. One of those.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. I never expected that conversation to go like that. That was wonderful.